Good evening, and welcome to Art World Innovators, exploring stories of innovation in the art world. I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and you're listening to UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Our guest this evening is illustrator and photographer David Kirshner, a world-renowned zoologist living in Australia and originally from Winnipeg. With his outstanding artistic skills and professional knowledge, he has contributed photographs and illustrations to many publications related to his work and has been a consultant and animal wrangler for a number of film documentaries, such as an episode of the BBC Life in Cold Blood series with David Attenborough, the 92-year-old BBC broadcaster of educational and natural history documentaries. David Kirshner is also a zoo and aquarium interpreter with a strong interest in the conservation of animals. David received the 2015 Whitley Medal from the Royal Zoological Society of New South Wales for his outstanding scholarly zoological publication, Biology and Evolution of Crocodilians, which he lavishly illustrated and co-authored with Gordon Grigg. Speaking with us tonight on his perspective of innovatively combining artistic skills with scientific practice is David Kirshner. Welcome to Art World Innovators, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Looking back, what would be your earliest memories of your passion for drawing and alligators?
It's actually quite a funny story. I had a neighbor that lived down the street, Mrs. Greenfield. I think she still lives on the same street. And she was a snowbird. She used to go to Florida every year. And in those days, you were able to buy stuffed alligators. And she had a couple that she bought in Florida as souvenirs. And I was probably about 4 years old, and I used to go down the street to play with them and draw them. So it wasn't the origin of my interest, but it was the first memory I have of being actively interested in both alligators and crocodiles and drawing them.
So where has this passion for crocodilians and wildlife taken you, and how did this inform your innovative artistic development?
Well, growing up, I always knew I'd either be a zoologist or an artist. And when I went to university, I decided that I was going to study zoology. I did a introductory course in fine arts at the University of Manitoba, as well as studied zoology. And then when I finished university, I ended up coming to Australia to do research on crocodiles, to follow my passion. When I finished my PhD, I wanted to get out of academia, and I had this real interest in combining my art and zoology by working in the zoo industry as an interpreter, essentially producing the graphics where I can inform people about various aspects of biology and conservation, and use the art side to explain things, and that's kind of where I took it.
Looking at some of your photographs and illustrations in publications such as the Encyclopedia of Mammals, your illustrations of wildcats or monkeys, for example, are exquisite in how you capture their expressions, their vibrant colors, the lines of their bodies, and the flow of their movements in their natural habitat. How did your extensive knowledge of the biological and physiological makeup of various species of living things help in your ability to capture the details of animal life in your illustrations?
Well, first of all, thank you. my biggest critics are actually the people whose criticism of my artwork I pay most attention to are other animal people, so zoologists and a lot of my colleagues, because they're the ones that understand the animals best. And they seem to love my work. So that, to me, that means more than anything. And I think to portray an animal correctly, you really need to understand how it moves and what the typical expression is. There's a lot of illustrations out there, a lot of paintings out there of wildlife where a person's looked at a static photograph, and the photograph may be taken at an awkward moment, and they've kind of assumed it's a typical pose. Or it's hard to explain, but there's very easy to tell an illustration done by someone that's not very familiar with animals is probably the best way to put it.
As far as photography, how did you incorporate photography into your work?
Well, my interest in photography goes back a really long way. And it's when back when everything was done non-digitally, when it was transparencies. And originally, I bought a camera to take photographs of things to use for reference. And so photography wasn't really the hobby in and of itself. And it was around the time I came to Australia that I really started spending a lot of time photographing wildlife and developed an interest in kind of building a library of photographs of different types of wildlife from around the world. And then it kind of became its own hobby, quite apart from my art, from my illustration and painting. And so now it actually competes with my other artistic side.
And do you have a lot of photographs in the encyclopedias or other publications?
Yes, I've got quite a few photographs all over the place in assorted books and in zoos and in displays and in various other places like that.
Where are some of the places that you've traveled to?
I've done a fair bit of traveling around Australia. I've been to South America, particularly Brazil. I've spent a lot of time in Brazil and North America, both Canada, the U.S., Mexico, Southeast Asia, Indonesia, Thailand. I spent a lot of time in Singapore. I was doing some work there. Southern Africa. I'm the Middle East as well. And I've still to go to a place I want to go next, probably India and Sri Lanka will be my next destination. Actually, a couple of years ago, I was working as a consultant, so I had time in my hands. And I decided I was going to catalog my photographs, all my digital photographs. So I was cataloging, I guess, photographs going back to 2003 when I first got a digital camera. So I was using Lightroom to catalog them, cataloging by location, by species. And I've got 150,000 photographs cataloged.
That is quite a lot.
Yes.
Did some of that experience help you in your work that you did with Sir Attenborough and the BBC on the documentary series about animals and natural history? And did these inspire you?
Well, David Attenborough, I don't think he's not as big in North America as he is in places like Australia and the UK. He's massive here in terms of being probably the most respected documentary maker when it comes to wildlife. And my interest kind of goes back actually to stuff I was doing in Australia, where I've got a real interest in mantle lizards. One of my hobbies is I keep and breed a type of lizard called a mantle lizard, which is quite a large, well, the species I keep is quite a large lizard that lives locally to me in Sydney. And I spend a lot of time out in the bush watching their reproductive habits and foraging habits and everything else. And the David Attenborough crew was starting to work on a series on reptiles called Life in Cold Blood. And one of the episodes was on lizards. And the producer was contacting a number of biologists. And a couple of them had recommended that they speak to me because they wanted to do a sequence about lace monitors, a particular species that nests in termite mounds. And so they contacted me. And because I was breeding this, there's certain aspects of their biology that you can't record in the wild, particularly what goes on inside the termite mound. These animals lay nests and they lay their eggs in termite mounds, and you can't really know exactly what day they're going to start hatching out in the wild and set up a camera inside there. So that sort of stuff has to be set up. And we end up setting up a termite mound in my home with eggs that I've got from my captive lace monitors. And so I had a cameraman camping out at my place when they were hatching. And it was a really interesting experience for me in seeing the things that we were doing and how they ended up on the final series. And it made me aware of how much work goes into a documentary as well, because we spent about 2 weeks worth of work, 4 minutes in the finished documentary.
Can you use your creative skills to enhance the goals of organizations associated with your interests for conservation of wildlife or endangered species of crocodiles, for example, with organizations maybe that you're involved in, such as the International Union for Conservation of Nature?
So mostly that's my zoology side, but I do use my artistic hat when I have to explain things to the public. You're trying to explain something complex and trying to simplify it so they understand it better, and I find that that's where the illustration really comes in handy. And so that's where I see my special skill set as being combining the zoology side with the artistic side and trying to explain something, trying to explain a concept. That's where the interpretation comes in.
And what would you advise students who want to combine various professional interests with artistic skills?
That's a good question. For one, I think practice is really important. I think one of the most important lessons I had is it's a bit of a story here, but when I first finished my studies, I just assumed that I'd be able to walk into a position somewhere at a zoo as an interpreter. Because I thought, I've got the zoological knowledge, I've got the artistic skill, why wouldn't they just snap me up? And I got a job at a zoo, working as a zookeeper with the idea in mind that I would develop this position. And I ran into all sorts of, it was a little bit of a struggle, because interpretation wasn't a big thing in zoos in those days. And there was also a lack of experience on my part in both the zoo world and in interpretation. And so I ended up going off on a tangent and working as an illustrator for a while. It was originally going to be an interim job that was going to just carry me over for a year or so until I found other work. And I ended up loving it. It was probably my favorite career ever. where I was just doing illustration work for books and for advertising and for all sorts of things like that. And I ended up doing it for about 14 years. And I don't know if you've ever read a book by Malcolm Gladwell called Outliers. And he talks about the 10,000 hours that people developing a skill set, to take it to the next level, you pretty much have to put in 10,000 hours. And that period of illustration was my 10,000 hours of illustrating. And it really helped me to be able to really quickly, especially with illustration, be able to summarize things really quickly visually. If I want to explain something, then I've got a fair idea of the key features I need to show to explain it quickly without making it too complex. And so I think that level of practice. So then when I stopped working as an illustrator, I went back into the zoo industry, and that's where I've been since then, working mostly as in the field of interpretation.
So it's a good combination. I suppose you almost feel like you might be an instrument of storytelling.
Oh, 100%. And that's probably, it's funny that you should say that, because it didn't occur to me until a few years ago that my whole life is about storytelling, and that sums me up. It's funny. I once had an ex-girlfriend in a moment of anger tell me that my life was one big anecdote. And I think she meant it as an insult, but I kind of went, yes. and now she's an anecdote. but it's true, though. That's what I do. It's storytelling.
It is great. Well, we're just running out of time, so I'd like to thank you very much for being on our show and sharing your intriguing story and insight with us. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you very much, Susan. It's a pleasure.
That was David Kirshner, zoologist, illustrator, and photographer, speaking with us from Australia. For those of you just tuning in, you are listening to Art World Innovators on UMFM 101.5. Our guest this evening is Valerie Metcalf, studio potter and a founding member of Stonework Gallery, a ceramic studio, retail shop, teaching space here in Winnipeg, and the longest-running artist cooperative in Canada. Valerie graduated with an honors Bachelor of Fine Arts degree from the School of Art at the University of Manitoba, where she discovered her love of making pots and a sense of the miraculous qualities of clay. Valerie's work has many influences, from teachers and fellow artists to the wide open skies, deep woods, and landscapes of the open prairies. Valerie's pottery has been exhibited nationally, internationally, and is held in numerous private and public collections throughout North America, Europe, and Asia. The province of Manitoba often presents her work to visiting dignitaries, including governor generals, the King and Queen of Sweden, President of Iceland, and more. Valerie is here tonight to tell us more about studio pottery and what is involved in running a cooperative gallery. Welcome to Art World Innovators, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Susan.
You mentioned in your artist statement that you're inspired by the wide open skies, our forests, and our prairie landscapes. Can you tell us how you express these natural elements in your work, perhaps by describing a piece or a series?
I would say the influence is expressed in the color that I use. When you work with porcelain, you're able to show the true color of the glazes. And, of course, as you know, our landscape is often pretty monochromatic. And I feel that through expressing color in my work, it helps to balance that sense of vast whiteness, white and blueness that we experience most of the year. And I also use nature-inspired design, leaves, patterns that kind of invoke being in the forest, or the way the light falls on them, the randomness that also creates a pattern.
So when you started out, did you experiment a lot with various materials till you got to the porcelain and doing functional or decorative pottery? How did you discover your preference?
I would say through experimentation. I was lucky enough right from the beginning to have access to a high fire reduction kiln, and that very much influenced the type of glazes and clay I would use. And everybody kind of starts out with stoneware. And when I tried porcelain, that's when I fell in love with what you could do with the pattern and color effects with it. But you are able to find a lot of depth through the high fire method. What we do is we reduce the available oxygen in the kiln. And because the fire still has to burn, it pulls the oxygen from the clay and the glaze. And this creates a marriage of the two that you can't find in other forms of firing, and a depth of color that you would only see in nature.
When you use porcelain, do you also throw the clay?
Oh, yes. It's right from the box.
Okay.
Right from a piece of mud. And that's why there's a bit of a sense of alchemy, because you take something that's you know, basically earth, and you turn it into precious material. At one point in history, porcelain was prized more than gold, in China specifically.
And what's your secret to throwing the clay well and getting it centered, and how long did it take you to reach that level of skill?
I was a slow learner, and I would say it probably took me about 6 months to learn how to center. And as far as learning how to throw really well, it's like learning a musical instrument. It's lots and lots and hours of practice. I'd say at least 15 years of long hours before your skill is finally starting to develop. But even at that point, there's always refinement and striving to make something better. There was a famous Japanese potter named Shoji Hamada who said it takes a lifetime and a half to be a good potter.
Do you have a vision of what you want your piece to look like before you start? And can you describe how it feels as the clay moves and forms under your touch?
I do have vision of a form or effect I'd like to create. That often changes as I'm working. Such a fluid thing. It is very much like music. So I would say throwing is the most pleasurable part when it's going well. There's a rhythm to it. There's a satisfaction and an immediacy in being able to shape something as to how you're envisioning it. And that, again, just comes with practice.
Can you describe a piece that you may have done recently or exhibited recently, explaining the colors and the lines, you know, what you really enjoyed most about it?
I guess I could talk about the piece that's in the cookbook that with the art gallery. I don't know if you're aware that at Crafted 2018, the art gallery has produced a cookbook where they united local chefs with local potters, and then the chefs created a soup recipe, and the magazine is very high quality production, so they're selling it for $10 a piece to raise money for Harvest.
Nice.
So the bowl that I submitted to be considered for that is one of my Forest Bowls series. I don't know if you're aware of the death of the Parker wetlands recently, but that was an issue that I felt very strongly about, and I created some pieces to capture the essence of the forest that was destroyed. So the bowl is on a pedestal. It's open and wide, and in the center, it's framed in white with a white base, and in the center is a deep green, almost black background with leaves that are swirling around and painted with a green and a white, like a blue-green and a white, and there's a bit of softness to it because they run a bit during the firing. Then I added some gold luster to the pattern to create another sense of depth to it and also to add value to that sense of the forest and the leaves. Anyway, the forest is all gone now. It's a tragedy.
It is. Who are some of your most influential teachers, models, or master potters?
Well, I studied under Robert Archambault and Charlie Scott, who passed away. Irish Flynn, who I think is still making pots in Montana, but he's retired. They were a major influence, as well as John Waddell, who started up the gallery here. And apart from that, I've always just loved looking at books and pieces. There's so many great ceramic artists out there. I've always loved the Japanese and Chinese pottery, the fineness and the exquisite form it has. That was definitely a major influence. And I think I'm also influenced by my British heritage. So maybe people have said that my work looks old and new at the same time. So that's kind of nice. I think of that as a compliment.
There's some amazing British ceramicists.
Yes.
Stonework Gallery has recently celebrated 40 successful years of art sales and exhibitions. That's a major accomplishment across the country. From your perspective, how does a cooperative differ from others, and what do you feel has been the foundation of your gallery's success?
I think the cooperative has been successful because the quality of the work in it is exceptional. We have made an effort. When we've had openings, we've made an effort to recruit people whose work will be different and yet complementary to what we have in here. And it's only pottery. For some reason, ceramics seems to be a particularly strong creative expression in Manitoba, probably due to the strength of the school of art during the 60s and early 70s. How it would be different from a commercial gallery would be that each artist here gets a significant area to display their work. So you can really see their vision and what they're trying to do. It's not just having three or four pieces here and there and displayed sort of helter-skelter amidst other pieces. apart from that, I can't really speak to commercial galleries because, you know, we are one, but we're not like, you know, one where we have shows or anything like that. Like the work is constantly new work coming out as the artist's work. And then all of us do show in other places, like other commercial galleries in town or outside town. Technically, it's not a cooperative in that the membership is limited. Technically, it's a limited partnership. I think a cooperative has to be completely open to however members want to join. We have figured out over the years the fairest way to treat everyone so that if there are problems, people are free to speak up. We try to delegate volunteer jobs for people to ensure that everything gets done. We keep really strict books and records, all done by hand still, of course, because we're pre-computer and we're too old to change and we can't figure out how to do it. So. But that's, you know, it seems to have worked. That's a very important part of running a cooperative, is knowing exactly how much money everybody needs to put in every month to make sure the bills can be paid and that you know you're not running into trouble.
If you were to encourage new and established potters to become members of your gallery, what kind of advice would you give them?
That they need to be prepared to produce a lot of work. I know when people have been hesitant about joining, it is because it's a big commitment and there's a fair amount of space for you to fill with your work. So you have to be prepared to, you know, work hard and produce a lot.
What have you enjoyed most about being part of and a member of the Stonewer Gallery?
Well, being able to make a living from my work, because if you make a living, then you can keep working. I mean, the money is important, but the money also gives you the freedom to keep doing what you're doing. And you don't, you know, I haven't had to get a part-time job somewhere so that I can make ends meet. I've been able to, luckily, do it through the sale of my work. And that's thanks to the people of Winnipeg and visitors here who respond to the work and have made an effort to support their local artists. Very important.
Winnipeg is really helpful there. The gallery also has an impressive stoneware studio. Can you tell us a little bit about the classes and the programs you offer?
Yes, the studio originally formed the gallery. And then over the years, as people moved on or, you know, their lives evolved in different directions, the studio members invited other people to become gallery members. So right now there's only 3 members out of 15 in the gallery that own the studio. So it's a separate business. The businesses are dependent on each other. I think that part of the success of the gallery, I should have mentioned this earlier, is the fact that we do have the studio in the back so that customers can readily see and possibly experience the process that goes into making pots. And right now we have about 80 students, which is huge. Yeah. We offer 8 classes a week. We concentrate on wheel throwing and try to educate the students as much as possible in the proper techniques and ability. We offer practice time along with classes so that, because of course it's really important. And if a student wishes, they can pay extra and have unlimited access to the space. It's quite a clay community. And clay tends to establish community because there's so much work involved in firing the kiln, loading the kiln, glazing. You need to have crews that you work with. And when people also share a common passion, you know, if they fall in love with the process, really is what you fall in love with. We try to keep people distanced from the finished product so they won't, you know, you have to be a bit philosophical because things don't always work out how you want. But they develop friendships and support groups, and without meaning to, the studio offers a solace to groups of people that meet here to practice and talk about their pots, and then they're always talking about their lives, and it has a whole side benefit to it that I didn't realize, you know, when we started teaching, that aspect would become so important.
I'd like to thank you so much for being our guest this evening and sharing your story and insight with our audience.
Well, thank you. Thank you for talking to me. Very happy to have been able to answer your questions.
That was Valerie Metcalf, potter and founding member of Stoneware Gallery here in Winnipeg. I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and we thank you for listening to Art World Innovators here on UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Join us again next Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 p.m. for more on today's innovators in the art world.